Hey there, listeners. Before we get started, I just wanted to give a shout out to our colleagues over at ABC News who are also covering the conventions on podcasts this week. Those podcasts are Start Here, which is a daily news podcast. They're going to be out every morning with the news from the conventions, as well as other important news from the day. Also check out the Powerhouse Politics podcast, which does in-depth interviews with newsmakers throughout the convention. Those are both going to be daily throughout the convention, so go check them out. Hello and welcome to this late night reaction edition of the 538 Politics podcast. I'm Galen Druk. We've just wrapped up night two of the Democratic National Convention. The theme for the night was leadership matters, but it was also the keynote night, which is when we usually hear from an up-and-coming star in the party. Tonight, it was 17 up-and-coming stars in the party. We also heard from Joe Biden's wife, Dr. Jill Biden. We also had the roll call ceremony where Joe Biden was formally nominated the Democratic nominee. It feels like it's been a long time that we have thought of him as the presumptive nominee, but it became official tonight. And so here with me to talk about what went down, our senior politics writer, Perry Bacon Jr. Hey, Perry.
Good evening, Gala.
Also here with us is elections analyst Nathaniel Rakich. Hey, Nathaniel.
Good evening, Galen.
And tech and politics reporter Kaylee Rogers. Hey, Kaylee.
Hey.
Perry, let's start off with the usual theme of the Tuesday night of the national convention, which is giving the rising stars in the party some time to speak and maybe give some indication of what the party thinks of its future. Tonight, that was 17 different people. What was going on there?
I don't necessarily view the keynote speech as always telling us that much. I don't remember who gave the keynote speech in 2016. I remember Obama gave it in 2004, but beyond that, I'm not sure the keynote tells us that much. So
it was Elizabeth Warren in 2016.
Elizabeth Warren. And before that, Julian
that's
Castro.
A big deal. She's yeah. a big Julian deal. Castro, it was Julian Castro in 2012. I don't know. It's a pretty big deal.
Okay, so I will take that under advisement. That's it. 17 people spoke. It was definitely like, I think they were all under 50s, my guess, you know, and they were all fairly young. And I didn't know some of them. This is my job. I didn't know some of them before they spoke tonight. I knew a few of them. I know Stacey Abrams, of course, who was kind of the biggest, who got to speak the most of that group. But in terms of like showing the geographic, ideological, and racial diversity of the party, it sort of made sense. And it, in terms of showcasing someone, I think it sort of reflects this whole Democratic convention, this whole process, which is like the Democratic Party is against Donald Trump. I'm not totally sure what it's for. And I think that was clear tonight. It's for diversity. It's for inclusion. It's against Donald Trump, but it's not really sure about what it is beyond that. It's for Barack Obama. Yeah, that as well.
Yeah, in some ways, Barack Obama is the most uniting force in the party. And he couldn't also give the keynote speech in addition to, right. I guess, his Thursday night intro of the nominee. Kaylee and Nathaniel, I'm curious what you made of how the party tried to paint its future stars or what its future looks like.
Yeah, I didn't really think it worked. You know, I think having a montage of the party's rising stars is a great idea, but I think once it lasted beyond 3-4 minutes, it started to get a little draggy and frenetic with all the cutting. Trying to actually put a speech together in a collage like that, I don't think worked as well. I think they should have probably done a montage, like I said, of people, you know, showing all the different faces of rising stars in the party, leading up to one person who was going to give the keynote address. They kind of did that with Stacey Abrams, who spoke at the end, kind of uninterrupted, but only for, you know, maybe a minute. I would have given her a lot more time, especially since she is a very good speaker and B, clearly someone that the party, all wings of the party, I think, can be excited about for the future. But, you know, I think like how many, like to Perry's point, like it is also my job to know these people. And I just watched them. How many of these, the keynote speakers of the 2020 DNC can I name now an hour after seeing them? 2, 3? Like, I think that's a sign that it didn't make a big impression.
Yeah, I think it definitely made it difficult for any one of them to really stand out in any kind of real way. Even some of the up-and-coming stars that we are familiar with, you know, didn't really get a chance to speak for more than like 10, 20 seconds at a time. you know, I kind of understand what they were going for, especially because given the constraints of a digital convention, you're not going to have that same kind of keynote speech with the reaction of the audience and sort of that energy within the room that you would get that enables you to have something like a 2004 Barack Obama speech. That just like was never going to happen with somebody sitting in front of their camera or like filming in their kitchen or something. So they tried to spice it up with something different, but I agree that it didn't quite work the way I think they hoped it would.
So Galen, I think you're implying though that it is a little bit of a problem that the party couldn't bother to choose someone. Like, you know, it is a little bit indication of a little bit of confusion that pick Abrams, pick AOC, pick Pete Buttigieg, just pick someone. It's not that hard, but it seems like they're too nervous to pick someone and suggest we all like this person. That's not necessarily a good sign.
Yeah, I mean, I think the party definitely has different wings that it worries about upsetting. I don't know that it's a problem at this point. Oftentimes, these things end up getting resolved through the primary process, and for now, Joe Biden is the person who suits that role. But do we know what the future of the Democratic Party looks like? I don't, and I wasn't given a better portrait of what that future looks like through the party's eyes by having 17 different people ranging from Connor Lamb, who is a more conservative Democrat who won a Trump district in a special election, and then also hearing from AOC or Stacey Abrams. I think the theme of this whole convention, as you've all said, is that you're going to hear from Colin Powell and John McCain, and you're also going to hear from Addie Barkin and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And as you said, the thing that unites all of those people is that they don't want Trump to be president anymore. What it looks like as a coalition in 2024 or what it looks like as a coalition in 2028, I don't know, but I'm curious. And I guess the question is, do we have any sense from the party of what they think their future looks like? Anyway, Kaylee, I did want to ask you, as you're covering the tech and politics beat for 538, what you make of the structure of this very abnormal convention via Zoom for the most part, with a lot of precautions for COVID. I know you've also been covering the COVID beat over the past several months.
Yeah, it's been interesting. I don't know if I'm just cynical, but I really had low expectations, especially because, you know, it was only a few weeks ago that they really confirmed that they weren't really going to do anything live in Milwaukee, including having Biden accept the nomination. I think we all thought there might still be a few things sort of in person in the more traditional sense. And so I wasn't sure how they were going to be able to pull it off, how creative they would get with it, or if they would just try to make, you know, have people at podiums and sort of project that outwards. So I think it's been kind of hit and miss. You know, we all agreed that the roll call tonight was really effective and kind of in some ways better than the normal roll call because we got to see like the home states and picturesque backdrops and interesting little tidbits there. And it was much snappier also. We got through it in like 30, 40 minutes. But then there's been other things where they've tried stuff that it hasn't quite landed, like the sort of Zoom applause that they keep cutting to after certain segments, which is really cringy. And I don't know why they haven't got the memo yet to like, don't do that tomorrow night. But, you know, they're trying something brand new here. They're breaking new ground. So I think we can be a little patient with it while also being extremely judgmental.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I loved the roll call. I do think it was interesting slash kind of sad. Well, I think it both reflected the fact that we at 538 are geography nerds, but also reflected the fact that the night overall was kind of blah, that pretty much everybody on our live blog said the best part of tonight was the roll call where we got to see all the different people against all the different backgrounds and all the pretty scenery in the states. But that was definitely my favorite part. The roll calls are always fun with all the regional accents and characters and things like that. But it was really cool. Like, honestly, it was the most traveling that I have done since last year.
I agree. The roll call was great and in part because everything else kind of wasn't. So we'll come back to the other stuff in a little bit. But yeah.
Talk to me a little bit more about that. Why was all the other stuff not so great?
Part of it might be that I don't necessarily agree with their sort of view of the electorate, maybe. Like the parade of kind of ex-Republicans speaking last night, I thought covered the subject. But apparently we needed to have Cindy McCain, John McCain, how bipartisan, Colin Powell. Like, these are all the same people as John Kasich and Chrissy Todd Whitman. You're expressing the same. I'm not sure how big the electorate is of sort of like elite establishment people who used to work in Washington, some of who still live in Washington, like Colin Powell, who don't like Trump. I just think that part of the electorate is very small. Joe Biden has already won those people. I don't know how much talking about them is like, how much touting them is that useful, in addition to them being kind of boring as a message. And yeah, I think their theory electorate is that, like, it's not necessarily that AOC should speak more, but I think that people who might reach demographics who Biden is not already doing well with might be like, we can talk about Latino voters. We can talk about, like, younger black people. We can talk about, they're just blocks of electorate he's not necessarily as strong with. But I think if you voted for Joe Biden in the primary or the general election, like, Joe Biden, Colin Powell, John McCain, that this is Joe Biden's base in a certain way, the sort of older, sort of more moderate person, center left or center right. So I found that part to be kind of tedious, to be honest with you. It's like, and also not interesting, and also probably not very effective.
I will say, I think that they didn't necessarily see at least the Colin Powell part in the same vein as last night. I mean, Colin Powell has been a Democrat for a while now. He endorsed Barack Obama. So I think they fit him into the national security portion of the evening as a way of saying, almost giving Joe Biden these almost, I guess, nonpartisan, which is partly what you're saying, but these nonpartisan credentials of, you know, keeping America safe, that he's equipped to do so. The McCain montage, I agree, maybe it would have been better suited for last night, especially right next to the, you know, they tried to shoehorn it in with the national security stuff, but I don't think it worked.
Perry, what you're getting at is an interesting point, which is, what does the party think that its goal should be with all of this? And we've talked about on this podcast that Never Trumpers are a very small segment of the electorate. You know, like, people who used to identify as Republicans or in many ways still do identify as Republicans who hate Donald Trump. So do they think that this is just doubling down on what was an effective strategy of turning out suburban voters in 2018? Because, like, if that's part of the strategy, then maybe it's understandable. But what are some of the specifics of what you think they don't understand about the electorate?
So what I would say is, they're very focused on saying moderate, 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 and very much saying not left, left. So they're viewing, like, AOC bad, you know, Colin Powell good, because we're trying to be moderate, not left. And I don't think most voters are that way. I think that a lot of people are disengaged in the electorate. A lot of people have, the data suggests, it's not that most people have views in the middle. They might be conservative immigration, but they might be liberal on something else. So if you're trying to reach voters that are more complicated, more unorthodox, more like people who are disengaged from the process, people who maybe didn't vote in 16, voted in 12. I just think that they're targeting sort of a high information, moderate kind of like John Kasich Republican. And I think we've had two nights of that. And I think the skill of AOC, or for that matter, Stacey Abrams, is not necessarily their ideology, but the people find them exciting or interesting or compelling. I think they're viewing AOC as like left. AOC left bad. And I think AOC good speaker, interesting, good. Don't have her say, we're going to like abolish ICE while she's speaking, but give her more time and give, you know, boring Republican X less time. Like, Ayanna Pressley could give a good speech. Like, I think they're missing the fact that the electorate is divided. They're missing the young party electorate. They're missing the Latino party electorate. They're missing the Asian party electorate. It feels like they have a lot of older white people and older black people talking, and that's Joe Biden's existing base.
Yeah, I got to say, it's hard not to feel like they're really taking the more progressive voters and progressive supporters for granted. Like, it's like, we know that they're not going to vote for Trump, so we've got them. It doesn't seem like they're taking any kind of risks or trying to reach some of those voters that they really do need to be reaching at this point.
Well, but Kaylee, I think that's exactly the point. They don't need to be taking risks because Joe Biden is up by 8 points right now. I think, you know, they're playing a very safe game, which I think makes sense given their position. I take your guys' point, certainly, but I do think that they don't feel a lot of pressure to kind of wrangle up the progressive Bernie Sanders supporters, because I do think that those people are in Joe Biden's corner because they just hate Donald Trump a lot and really want to get rid of him and will happily, maybe not happily, but will be content to pull the lever for Joe Biden to do so. That said, to Perry's point, I definitely agree about some of these other constituencies within the Democratic Party that could be featured more. I thought it was interesting. There were a lot of Native American speakers and delegates in the roll call. I do think that there could be a lot more Hispanic and Asian representation. You know, that's a complaint that I've heard particularly about Hispanic voters, and Joe Biden's polling numbers among Hispanic voters have been kind of, you know, weak or below replacement level for a Democrat. So that might be something they would want to gin up, the way that they clearly seem to be appealing to Black voters and to increase Black turnout, for instance.
Like, I might have Joe Manchin speak more instead of Colin Powell. That's kind of what I'm getting. It's not even ideological. It's more like someone who speaks to not elite voters. Like, it feels like the party strategists who are like DC people were like, who is my list of people in DC who I think of as being the DC view as a swing of a swing voter is like the John Kasich person. I think the actual swing voter who matters is the sort of West Virginia person who voted for Trump, but also voted for, if you're going to like try to appeal to the sort of white non-college voter, do that. And I think they're not really doing that as far as I can tell.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I want to dig into that a little bit more. But first,
hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We were talking about some of the constituencies that the Democrats don't seem to be trying to reach out to, or either maybe take for granted or don't feel like they need to win over in order to win this upcoming election. We mentioned Latino voters. We mentioned non-college educated white voters. What do we know about how Biden is doing with some of these groups from looking at the more recent polling? Putting on a show at the DNC is one thing. You know, looking at where his actual support looks like on the ground is another.
The crosstab suggests he's doing well with, he's doing better than Hillary with older people. That's the big thing. Over 55, he's doing better. His enthusiasm number is a little soft for people under 30, but again, they're saying they're voting for him. They're just not that excited about voting for him, so that's something. He's losing white voters without college degrees, but he's losing them by a slightly less margin, lower margin than Hillary Clinton is. He's doing really well with white people with college degrees. So that's kind of the broader look at where he is. Like, again, he's ahead by 8 to 9 points, so he's doing a lot of things right. So I don't want to be overly critical of someone who's winning by a lot. But if the race gets tighter overall, like if Trump gains like 3 or 4 points because it becomes a close race, if I were Biden, I'd be trying to shore up kind of like younger voters in particular, and to try to minimize that white without degrees gap. And to me, I'm watching a convention that seems very appealing to the sort of white suburban college voter who he already is doing well with.
So given that this is the 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, I was looking at some polling around women support for Biden. So there was a recent CBS poll, had him polling among women at 52% to Trump's 42%, and one from Fox had him with 51% versus 39% for Trump. But when you start to break it down by race, it was interesting. So it was 67% support for Biden among non-white women, 44% from white women. And I know that it's, you know, sort of often brought up that white women in the majority voted for Trump in 2016. And so that's a demographic that he's going to need to want to try to hold on to. Notably, also just the voter gender gap has remained pretty wide in the last few elections. So it was 10 points in 2012, 11 in 2016. And, you know, this recent Fox poll was 12 points. So if it stays around that range, it could be another kind of historic gap between men and women voters.
Yeah, I was surprised that they didn't make a bigger deal out of the fact that literally today is the 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote. I think the delegate from Tennessee, which was the state that ratified the amendment and put it over the top. She mentioned it. I believe Tom Perez mentioned it in his remarks. Maybe one or two other mentions, but I'm surprised there wasn't at least a segment devoted to it, given the importance of women in the Democratic Party.
So the one thing I would say is what I'll remember about tonight was, I don't think I knew much about Jill Biden. I'll be totally honest with you about that. I've covered Biden. Biden's been in our lives for a long time now, but I could tell you about how Michelle and Barack met and how they, you know, their first dates. And I think we all sort of knew a little bit more about their relationship. I think this filled out for me a lot of the Jill Biden story. And I think in a pretty compelling way. I think I knew she was a teacher and had taught at community college. I think it's basically all I knew about her. So in that sense, the polling suggests that a lot of people who are voting for Biden are voting for Biden because they hate Trump. And that makes sense. But I think if you're the Biden campaign, you want more people to be voting for Biden because the positive things about Biden. I think tonight there were some nods to Biden has foreign policy experience. He's a bipartisan person. And to some extent, he's a nice man who's a nice husband. That's and who's had a challenging life and whose wife died early on, whose son died at some point. I do think tonight was effective in sort of giving more of that Joe Biden story. And I think Jill did a good job with that. And I think if people stayed up for that, I think they probably do know more about both the candidate and his wife than they did before.
Yeah, that definitely felt like an introduction of her, even though obviously she was a second lady. It just, like you said, she just wasn't as much in the public eye and wasn't as big of a player in that way. So this was sort of like her little introduction night. And they did a nice job with that piece. It was interesting. There was even some funny moments. I think we were all surprised by like the snake anecdote from her grandchildren, which I didn't see coming.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, it was pretty clearly focused more on boosting Biden in the second night than attacking Trump, which was the very clear theme of the first night. You talked about this actually on a previous podcast, Perry, which is that so far Biden's unfavorables are not close to Trump's unfavorables. And really what won Trump the election was Hillary Clinton's unfavorables getting somewhat close to his unfavorables, and then people who dislike both of them breaking for Trump in the end. And so it seems like tonight was about like keeping those numbers up a little bit. I mean, do we know where those numbers are at right now? Are we anywhere close to the historic numbers that we saw in 2016?
Biden's at like 40% favorable, 42% unfavorable. It's like fairly close. His favorable to unfavorable versus Trump's number of unfavorables is sort of more like 41-54, if I remember offhand here. So, I mean, but we should note, I think Joe Biden's unfavorable numbers will go up next week for sure, because I think that'll be the entire focus of the presentation, will be to drive those numbers up. And I don't know how important it is for Biden to have, I think it's important that he doesn't go up to Hillary levels, but I think there are reasons that that won't happen. He's not been in the public eye. He was vice president. Let me pause for a little bit. So he's been in the public eye for a long time, but he's not had the sustained attention and the sustained attacks Hillary Clinton has. He's a white man. Hillary is a woman. I think that's relevant here too. So I don't know how important it is to boost up, but I do. If I was going to say that, I mean, I do think they've given the case that Biden is a good, nice, kind family man. I still think if I were them, I'd try to figure out how do I build the case for Biden has some policy views. Like, I think at this point, if you ask the average person, they know that Bernie Sanders is going to fight for their health care and so on. I don't think people would be able to describe what Joe Biden's two or three top policies are. And you've heard a little bit that Joe Biden cares about health care tonight, but who doesn't? So I'll be curious if they sort of try to fill that out in the next couple of days, like his actual, like, what will he go into office to do on day one?
Perry, it's the soul of America.
Right, it's the soul of America. That's they're going to restore the soul of America, exactly.
All right, so it's getting late here on the East Coast. We're about a quarter of an hour away from Wednesday, so I want to give people the opportunity to give some closing thoughts on either the evening or the two nights that we've seen so far, or if you want to preview anything, you're welcome to do that too. I know that tonight was not quite the fiery night that we saw on night one.
It is striking, like watching that first hour, It is a very diverse party, just in terms of even thinking about the accents they featured in that first Rising Stars, people's accents, how they sounded, how they looked. It is striking to, they have decided to accentuate that, but I think in both the Rising Stars segment and the actual like roll call, that was important. I think it, like, there were Native Americans, there were Black, Latino, white, you know, older, younger. I think that diversity is definitely the story they want to tell. And it is interesting. It's a, like I was talking about yesterday a little bit, it's an interesting story where you have Joe Biden, who is kind of like almost every other presidential nominee except for Obama and Hillary. He's an older white man, but they have tried to sort of meld, you know, we are bringing the diversity of the country forward with Joe Biden as the leader of it. It's sort of a weird message, but they're definitely trying to really emphasize that in some ways it's not that is that Joe Biden is the leader of this multiracial, multicultural movement. And that's kind of where we are now. So we're not going to choose a new vision. We're kind of like presenting a lot of visions forward because we don't know what our new vision is. We're behind Joe Biden. We sort of know that we were trying to get past Joe Biden too. It's a very interesting convention in that way.
Something I thought was interesting, not about tonight, but about last night, were the TV ratings. So the preliminary ratings are that 18.7 million people watched Monday night's proceedings on television, which is down quite a lot from the 26 million that watched the first day of the 2016 DNC. And I thought that was interesting. I kind of was thinking the ratings would go up because people are sitting around at home being bored, but that was quite a decline. So maybe it's the case that without the stagecraft of a real convention, people just aren't that interested. It could also be just changing viewership habits. So a lot more people are probably streaming the convention online than did in 2016. So according to the Biden campaign, an additional 10 million people on top of that 18.7 streamed the convention, which brings it a lot more in line with the 2016 numbers. But also those 2016 numbers don't include streaming either. So, you know, and streaming was a thing back in 2016. So probably overall, there's still a decline. So I found that to be interesting. Based on tonight being frankly not as interesting as last night, I would expect the ratings to be even worse tonight. And if you look at that overall in the aggregate, you know, in terms of what we think about its impact on the race, I would expect probably, I think you were already expecting not much of a convention bounce because opinions of Biden and of Trump are already so baked in. We're in a very polarized environment. But I think when you have relatively few people watching the conventions, my expectations for a bounce are even lower than they were going into the convention.
I think for me, it's been really interesting. So on the first night, there was a lot of acknowledgement and emphasis of this weird, difficult time that we're in, obviously with COVID, but also with the Black Lives Matter movement and all of the things that have been happening sort of around the world, kind of acknowledging that while also trying to do a normal political convention where you're just rallying around the party and the candidate. Tonight felt like they kind of had put that aside a little bit. So I'll be interested to see if they bring that back up again in the nights to come, or if they're trying to just sort of get back and focus on the party spirit and focusing on those things. I was trying to think if there was any, obviously this is very unique in that it's all online, but I was trying to think if there was even another presidential year where there was such a sort of overwhelming other story happening that was taking over people's minds. And I don't know that it's ever been quite like this, you know, even 9/11 was far enough removed from 2004 that I don't think it really overshadowed it in the same way that COVID is kind of taking precedence now, which also might explain some of the viewership numbers. I mean, people just have other things going on. They might not want to watch this.
I have also found, as talking to people, the Postal Service story is really riveting to people in a way that the convention kind of isn't. And today you had the news about this. I know the Russiagate story has been going on a long time, but I think the news today of this big report from the Senate Intelligence Committee about Russia, today was one of those days that was striking where I don't think the convention, like the New York Times and the Post have a lot of stories about the convention right now, but to me the biggest stories of the day were the Postal Service and the Russia story, not the convention. And I think that's striking. And to tell, I mean, this is, we're in this like really heavy news time where there's a lot of like what I would call real news happening, and the convention feels a little less important than it would have most years. Maybe I think it'll be different when Kamala and Vice President Biden speak, of course, but like tonight did not feel comparatively important compared to the actual news that happened during the day.
Yeah, that makes me wonder, Perry, if there's an argument for networks newspapers being like, hey, we didn't even send a bunch of people to cover this anyway. It's not like we have a huge investment. Let's cover COVID more heavily. I don't know. Maybe it's just habit at this point. We all have to watch it. We all have to comment on it and have our say. But yeah, it is a good reminder that it's like the fourth most important story of the day, potentially. All right. Well, now that we have thoroughly kind of knocked the convention off of its high horse, let's wrap up this podcast. So thank you, Perry.
Thanks, Kaylee.
Thank you, Nathaniel.
Thanks, Kaylee.
And thank you, Kaylee.
Thank you.
And let me also take a moment to plug the 538 store. It's got hats, shirts, totes, etc. That's all at 538.com/store. Go check it out. Again, that's 538.com/store. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.